Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome into another edition of Slow Your Roll. It will once again be a solo episode, so a little bit different style once again here. I am Dominic Lorenzano, local broadcaster, and you know, Jesse, he'll be back when he can be back, but we'll go over some topics real quick. Start with the college football playoff and that controversy. Talk a little bit of Pats, the Philly-San Francisco game. I'll tell you why Philly has some problems, but I don't care that much about the outcome of that game. It doesn't change my opinion of the Eagles all that much. Talk some Jordan Love, our winter meetings, what's going on in baseball, Juan Soto, the big move that just happened, and finishing it up with our gambling segment. So, but anyway, with that, now that I don't have anyone here to drag me down when it comes to talking college football, let's touch on some college football and start with the big controversy, the college football playoff, in which undefeated conference champion, the Florida State Seminoles, were left out. Now, many people, particularly Seminole fans, are calling this a travesty. I don't know if I'd quite go that far, but it is kind of ridiculous, and they did get screwed. They are an undefeated conference champion in a Power 5 conference. They are also sort of a historic school with a historically good football program. Now, Seminole fans, you do have to completely be honest. You are not the same team that racked up all your big wins now that you are without Jordan Travis. You are not the same football team. But to the college football committee, if you're going to set this precedent where you're going to leave out an undefeated conference champion in a Power 5 school, you better have a dominant juggernaut that you're putting in over them. And I don't think that's that Alabama team this year. Bama needed a miracle to beat the 6-6 Auburn Tigers just a week before that Georgia SEC game. Bama almost lost to USF at one point this season. Alabama is the only, I repeat, the only of these top, not even top six, Bama is the only one loss team. And by the way, Oregon has two losses, but Oregon also didn't even do this. Bama is the only one of those top teams and one loss teams that lost a game at home. The rest of them lost them on the road in hostile environments or on neutral sites. Alabama is the only one to lose in their own building, and they lost by 10. So this is not a dominant Alabama team that you're putting in over a conference champion Seminoles. Also, let's not act like the Georgia team that the Tide just beat was the 2021 or 2022 Georgia team. It's not the same football team. Most of those Bulldogs are in the NFL. It's not the same team. Their best player, Brock Bowers, was playing at way less than 100% to win that game. So it's not like they beat the same dominant Georgia team. That Georgia team also played one of the weakest schedules of any of these top schools. So I think this is a bit egregious that you would leave the Seminoles out for this Alabama team. The SEC, by the way, also some last notes, had a losing record outside of conference this season. And a common opponent, LSU. Both Bama and the Seminoles beat LSU. But Florida State shut down the Heisman favorite now, Jaden Daniels, in that offense, took it to him in the second half. Alabama did win the game, but they knocked Jaden Daniels out of the game with a cheap shot early in the fourth quarter. Now, Alabama was probably going to win that game no matter what, but if you think that Jaden Daniels didn't at least have a chance to bring them back, you haven't been watching enough college football. So the common opponent, to me, the Seminoles were more convincing over LSU. It was a better win than Alabama's win over the Tigers. So all in all, I think the Seminoles got screwed here. And again, if you're going to leave out a conference champion undefeated, now I know the ACC was down, but if you're going to leave out a team like that, you need a legit juggernaut, highly impressive team you're putting it over. And to me, that wasn't Alabama this year. 6-6 needed a miracle to beat Auburn, almost losing to USF, and got dominated in their own building by the Longhorns. The Seminoles, they did get screwed. But, you know, the committee decided to go with what would make more money, maybe. They decided to go with, well, the Vegas odds are, I don't want to hear that. they matter a little bit, but at the end of the day, games are played, and the games have to matter. And Florida State won all their games. And by the way, their conference championship game was ugly. I understand that. But they were playing with a third-string quarterback. Their backup will be back for the playoffs. Now, Jordan Travis won't be, but you got to figure that the backup can throw more than 55 yards. And it was a Seminole defense, by the way, that completely dominated the game against a ranked Louisville team. Shut them down. So I feel sorry for Mike Norvell. I feel sorry for the players and for the fans. You guys got screwed. You got screwed. 100%. Now, you got to admit, you're not the same team without Travis. You got to admit, maybe there's a chance Bama probably has a better game against Michigan than you would. But at the end of the day, the games have to matter. And if you're going to go undefeated and win your conference championship, there shouldn't really be much debate. Especially when, as I just laid out, it's not like this is the most impressive Alabama team or Alabama resume that you've ever seen that you're going to put them in over an undefeated conference champion. Absolutely ridiculous. So let's start on that note, and let's talk quickly about the playoff itself this year. We got a couple of good matchups here. Alabama-Michigan, I believe the line is about 1. I don't know why it's quite that close, just because they beat Georgia, who we just mentioned isn't the same Georgia team. I kind of really like Michigan in this matchup. Maybe they feel that Ohio – I mean, listen, Bam, Michigan dealt with Ohio State with their pro talent at wide receiver just fine. Now, you know, they clearly fear Jalen Milroe at this point is significantly better than McCord. I don't know. But I like Michigan in this matchup. What I really like, though, I like the Longhorns to win this whole thing. I think the Longhorns have the, at least maybe not the most, but just as much NFL personnel as Alabama or Michigan. They have a professional quarterback in Quinton Ewers who will go to the NFL. He'll be a draft pick. They have NFL guys at wide receiver, good running game. They've also, outside of what usually you think of the Big 12, the Longhorns have played real defense. Particularly, they've been very stout up front stopping the run. Washington is not a great defense. I don't expect them to be able to slow down the Longhorns. And I expect the Longhorns to be able to apply pressure to Penix. And I expect them to be able to shut down the Husky run game. Now, once they get past Washington, if they get past Washington, I should say, but I'm very confident they will get past the Huskies. When they play in Michigan or in Alabama, yes, those teams stack up in the trenches a little bit better, but Texas shut down Bama pretty well and shut down the Bama run game very well when they beat them in Tuscaloosa, not like the Bama went to Austin, in Tuscaloosa. And I just think between Bama and Michigan, I think Texas is more dynamic on the outside than both of those teams. And they have a better quarterback. I know JJ gets a lot of hype and praise, and he'll go to the NFL, I'm sure. I don't think at this point J.J. McCarthy is that polished yet. I think Quinton Ewers is a better quarterback. So I think Texas has more dynamic players on the outside. They have a better quarterback and just a more explosive offense. I don't think Bama and Michigan have the ability to counter the explosiveness of Texas. And all it takes in a close game is one blown coverage, or you just throw a ball up and let your athletes, who are better than the other ones, make a big play down the field. And that's why I like the Longhorns to win this entire thing. I think they're about plus 300, maybe plus 275 right now. They are third of the four teams behind Bama and Michigan, who I believe Vegas has ranked as the same odds. But I don't know. Not a big Sark fan, but I just love the Texas personnel, and I like the matchups they're going to get. Would I be a little bit more concerned about the Longhorns if they had to play Georgia? Yeah, a little bit, as long as Bowers was healthy and stuff. But I think the Longhorns just stack up very well with everybody else right now in this playoff. So that has been it for our college talk here for a second. Let's pivot to the Patriots. I mean, I don't really even want to talk that much about that game. I mean, the offense is embarrassing. It's been embarrassing. However, the defense continues to play very well, which I think is still a testament to how good of a coach Bill Belichick is. And I think it's Bill Belichick, the GM, that has screwed over Bill Belichick, the coach. But he remains a great coach. And I want to bring that in because there's talk about all the open jobs. Every year there's about 6 to 8 open jobs. I've heard rumors there could be as many as 8 or 9 this year, which is crazy. But even if there was that many openings, I don't think there's a ton of great candidates this year. You can try and get Jim Harbaugh away from college. Ben Johnson, the OC at Detroit, he's a good one. Eric Bieniemy, I guess, although Washington's fallen off. Now, most of that is the defense, I'm sure. But still, I mean, there must have been a reason Bieniemy was having trouble getting head coaching offers before that. So I don't think there's a ton of great candidates this year. And at this point, it seems pretty obvious Bill's going to be done here in New England. Kraft's not going to run this back. I wonder if even Bill wants to come back at this point. Like, I'm not trying to blame anyone specifically here. I mean, sometimes it's just time. And it feels like it's just time. But if Bill doesn't want to go away, and I don't think he does, he's a very football-obsessed individual, I think he's going to have a lot of jobs that are interested in him. And the other key thing is, Josh McDaniels isn't going to be a head coach. So Bill's won a lot with Josh McDaniels. We make a big thing out of the Bill Brady thing. I think the ones who really needed each other was Josh and Bill. Because Bill's a genius on his side of the football, but he's not very good at the other side. And he's not very good at drafting it. Now, I highly doubt if he goes to a place, I doubt that team would give him personnel decision-making anyway. But at the end of the day, if he can have someone that he can trust on the other side of the football, everything that has shown you this season, especially over the last 3 weeks, despite the fact the offense can't do anything to help the defense, Bill still knows what he's doing coaching-wise, especially on the defensive side. The Patriots, missing their two best players, Judon and Christian Gonzalez, have continued to ball out on defense. You don't think that the Washington Commanders, with Sam Howell, who looks like he has some promise, and some nice offensive weapons, you don't think they'd be interested in Bill Belichick to fix that defense, that terrible defense? I think they'd be pretty interested. I think there's a number of teams that would be very interested, and with good reason, to get Belichick. I don't think Belichick's washed up. I think Belichick is terrible at drafting. I think he's a terrible personnel guy, especially, and it's gotten worse and worse as the league changed. And when he lost Brady, who couldn't get below average to average offensive talent to be better. So it just showed the holes in Bill's drafting ability more. But I think Bill's going to have a lot of offers. A lot of really good offers too. Because like I said, other than Ben Johnson and then the hope that maybe you can swoo Jim Harbaugh away from Michigan, I don't think there's a lot of great candidates out here. And they continue to play well on defense. So clearly Bill can still coach, and you bring Josh McDaniels with him. I don't think Belichick is done under any circumstances. Now, he needs to be done in New England. He cannot come back here, especially considering when you gave him personnel, the power of personnel, he's not just going to give that back. Now, if he got a new job somewhere else, I'm sure he'd be more likely to accept having a GM. But he's not going to lose. He's not going to give power away here. This is not how that works. And you don't want to, when you need to rehaul so many things on the offensive side here, Bill Belichick's not the one that you want coaching it or picking it. So he's got to be done here. That doesn't mean he's done as a football coach. And I think he's going to have success somewhere else. And I think he's bringing Josh with him. The Commanders, probably where I lean right now, unless they want to hire Bieniemy. But Bill's going to coach somewhere else next year. Count on it. All right. With that, we are going to take our first quick break. When we come back, we'll talk about that NFC showdown between the two juggernauts, the Eagles and San Francisco, and then some thoughts on Jordan Love, and we'll move to some baseball talk. Stick with us, guys. And we are back here at Slow Your Roll, battling through a lot of things here with this show today. Between being alone and getting over a head cold a little bit, I'm sure my voice is going to change at multiple times during the show today. But let's move on to the Philly-San Francisco game. The Eagles, after narrowly escaping, it seemed, week after week, got hammered at home by the 49ers. Now, I do think there are some takeaways on that game, although I think you would have known coming into that game there were already weaknesses of the Eagles. Philadelphia defensively is extremely reliant on their D-line to get pressure. Their linebackers are not very good, and their corners are pretty average as well. It's a pretty average secondary. So they are extremely dependent on a D-line to be able to get pressure and to take the pressure off of their linebackers and secondaries, particularly when the linebackers have to be in coverage. So that is the problem with the Eagles. And, I mean, you saw that. The Niners burn that again and again. They have the personnel to do it between Deebo Samuel and Brandon Ayuk. So there are problems with the Eagles, but this is not a 45-19 game when they meet again. These are still pretty close teams. The spot was just horrible for the Philadelphia Eagles. They were 10-1. San Francisco had three losses, so the game meant a lot more to the Niners, who needed to win this game to stay alive for the number one seed, whereas the Eagles could afford a loss. But the biggest thing is just what the Eagles had to do going into that game, and it was pretty obvious, I thought, late in that game, that Philly simply just kind of ran out of gas. The Eagles had just played the Cowboys, the Chiefs, and the game literally right before this one, an overtime game against the Buffalo Bills. I mean, that's a tough stretch. Those are two playoff teams, for sure, the Cowboys and Chiefs, high-end playoff teams. And then a Buffalo team that underachieves, but is highly talented, with a dynamic quarterback and a very good offense, or at least a explosive offense. And it was a desperate Buffalo team that you knew was going to give you everything they had, and it went to overtime. So this was a completely exhausted Eagles team. I'm sure the D-line was exhausted. So that's why I don't take a ton of stock out of this game. I think these two teams are pretty close. I think specifically maybe there are some matchup problems for the Niners that the Eagles have with the Niners, I mean. But the Niners create matchup problems with everyone. And you know what the biggest person who's a problem for opposing defenses? And that's Deebo Samuel. Because he's such a hybrid player. And by the way, Christian McCaffrey is this too. The thing that makes the Niners so tough, other than Trent Williams is a great left tackle, one of the best of all time, and Kyle Shanahan's a great play caller. But Deebo and Christian, you have one who is a running back in McCaffrey and one who plays like a running back in Deebo Samuel, but they both have great hands and run routes, and they go out and they catch passes in the secondary. I mean, when you run the ball with your running back, if he reaches the second level and gets into the secondary, as a defense, you know you're in trouble. You've given up a big play, and it could get worse because it's tough for the smaller secondary guys to bring down a physical running back like that in space, one-on-one. Like, he'll just run over a lot of guys. Well, the Niners have two basically physical running backs that have the ball immediately at the second level of the defense in the secondary because they're great route runners and pass catchers. Deebo, when he has the ball in his hands, doesn't move like a wide receiver. He doesn't go out of bounds. He looks to make contact with people. He looks to run over people and inflict pain. And he has speed as well. But these aren't normal wide receivers. Deebo's not a normal wide receiver. Christian McCaffrey is a running back. So you have just big physical people consistently catching the ball in the secondary and then going against corners and safeties that are running backs. And it's just a nightmare matchup for opposing defenses. And that's why there's such a big difference, I think, with the Niners' offense this year when Deebo was out as opposed to when Deebo is in. It's a complete, complete matchup problem. And it's just hard for defenses to counteract it. You can't put a linebacker on Deebo Samuel. He's a wide receiver. And Christian is still a better route runner and faster than most linebackers too. So it's just a problem. You have safeties covering them. And as I said, Deebo is a big physical wide receiver when he has the ball in his hands runs like a running back. So it's tough for a safety or a corner to bring him down. You saw that on that big run that he got when he caught that ball over the middle field. Breaks a tackle, just kind of lowers his shoulder and shrugs the defender off him. The Niners are just a nightmare. And you have a great trigger man in Brock Purdy who is able to deliver the football to these guys and get it to them. And it's amazing to me the hate that I've heard in the media now for Brock Purdy. He's this, he's that. Well, more it's he's not this and he's not that. And, oh my gosh, the weapons. And he's got Kyle Shanahan. And, well, they had Debo and Kittle. And Kyle Shanahan always gets a good run game, even before McCaffrey, with Jimmy Garoppolo. And they didn't put up points like this. And the other thing I think is hilarious when we talk about this, there are people in someone I like in the national media, Colin Cowherd, brought this up before the Eagle-Niner game, putting up stats of, when Brock Purdy trails in a game next to Jalen Hurts. And it's like, wait a minute, Colin, Brock Purdy's played in 18, 19 NFL games? Put up Brock Purdy's stats compared to Jalen Hurts' stats through the first 18 to 19 games of their career. I bet you Jalen's aren't that great. Now, Jalen popped year three, A.J. Brown, and it's year three, which Patrick Mahomes even said, as talented and great as he was, the light bulb didn't quite go on reading defenses until year three. Brock Purdy hasn't even played a full 2 years. He's barely played a full 1 year in the NFL. And we're already going to tear him down. But this is his stats when trailing. Well, he hasn't trailed that much, and it's hard for a young quarterback when trailing. I mean, we want perfection here. 18, 19 games into his NFL career. They put up more points now than they ever did with Jimmy Garoppolo, consistently. And Brock Purdy runs the offense effectively. His sophomore slump has basically been one three-game stretch in the middle of the season, and one of those losses against a Browns defense that's probably a top three, at worst top five defense in the league, on the road, in weather. And even though he played terrible throughout the entire game, at the end of the game, brought them down the field and in position to kick a game-winning field goal. I don't understand what we're nitpicking here with Brock Purdy. Do we expect him to be Patrick Mahomes or Jalen Hurts now? It's 19 games into his career. They're putting up like 30 points a game. They are crushing people. Brock Purdy gets the ball out and on time and on target. And yes, he does get some credit for the yak yards. You know why? Because he hits his guys in stride. So many times, Christian and Debo don't even have to break stride to get the ball. Brock Purdy is accurate. Brock Purdy sees the field. He processes it quickly, and he gets the ball where it needs to be. And that's all Kyle Shanahan needs in his system in this offense. And he runs it way better than Jimmy Garoppolo ever did, who got multi-million dollars to start for the Raiders this year. Brock Purdy runs the offense way better than Garoppolo ever did. Brock Purdy is a high-end starter in this league already, and he's 19 games into his career. I don't understand why we need to nitpick this. No one expects him to be Drew Brees, Tom Brady, from trailing in a game already when he's only played 19 games. It's ridiculous, the nitpicking. And from one young quarterback, and as I said, if they play again, it'll be closer. Will I probably be picking the Niners? Yes, because of the established problems with the Eagles. But you got to remember, when these teams play again in the playoffs, likely for the NFC Championship, the stretch of games that the Eagles were on before they had to play this game, and they really ran out of gas at the end. Completely understandable. We'll see how they look against the Cowboys this week. If they get shredded by the Cowboys offense as well, especially throughout the entire game, whereas it was kind of just the fourth quarter, it felt like, last game where they got shredded. It was the third quarter. I don't know. But then maybe we can start pressing a red button with the Eagles a little bit more. But for now, calm down. Remember that stretch that they were on before that game. Cowboys, Chiefs, overtime against the Bills. It's tough. That's a tough stretch. All right. But from the Brock Purdy talk to another young quarterback, Jordan Love. And I loved Jordan Love coming out of college. I didn't know what to think. At times, he looked really ugly this year. But I said to Jesse and on this show when Aaron left for the Jets, like Green Bay, you wouldn't just let Aaron walk if you weren't confident that you at least had something, right, in Jordan Love. And we've seen it. And Green Bay, I feel like, did it the right way. Now, it's excessive how long he sat on the bench. You can't ask a franchise to be able to do that. But even when Jordan played this year, it felt like they eased him into it. You know, super conservative early. A lot of defined plays, defined reads. They went through their struggles also, especially the middle part of the year. But it seems like the last 3 weeks, they've really just turned Jordan Love loose, and for good reason. And now two of them were against really bad defenses. So I think people took that with a little bit of a grain of salt. But the Chiefs are a really good defense. This is the best defense that Patrick has played with in Kansas City. And Jordan Love was great. Jordan Love tore them apart in Green Bay, in the cold, in the weather, 25 of 36, three touchdowns, no picks, a passer rating of 118. And as Patrick tried to continue to answer in the second half and bring his Chiefs back, Jordan Love went blow for blow, swing for swing, continuing to bring his team back. This is a team that I think I will be invested heavily financially into next year when it comes to futures things. This is such a young team. Jordan Love is young. The wide receivers, Dobbs, Christian Watson, Wicks, Jaden Reed, all so young. And this team is going... this team will be ascending, and I think just great things to come. You know, it felt like last year Aaron just didn't fit anymore with the culture and what the roster was, all these young kids. Jordan Love fits. It fits, especially with some of the playmakers and speed guys you have in Dobbs and Watson. And like Jordan Love, sometimes the athletic, the off-platform, off-the-back-foot throws he makes sometimes can remind you of Aaron Rodgers. But he is closer to Favre than he will be Rodgers. I feel like he's actually kind of a mix between Patrick and Favre a little bit. Gunslinger like Favre, probably going to make some mistakes like Favre. But he's got the wiggle and the athleticism and the mobility of Patrick, not to the point where he looks to run as much like a Lamar or a Kyle, but does it to extend plays and make throws. And he's got a whip of an arm, just like Favre and Mahomes. So he's another one, though. He's not going to be a perfect player. He's going to miss a lot of easy stuff, I think. They'll correct some of that. I'm sure he'll miss more easy stuff now than he will later in his career. But I think he's always going to be kind of a streaky player. And he's a playmaker. He's not a surgeon like a Joe Burrow or a Drew Brees was or a Tom Brady or a Peyton. He's a playmaker. So he's going to miss some easy stuff. And he's going to be streaky. So they'll go through some stretches. By the way, Patrick does this. Patrick did this a lot last year where mechanically he kind of just goes off the rails. I think Jordan's going to be kind of like that. But boy, when he is on, he is on. And he can shred any defense and create big plays for anybody. I'm excited. I'm excited for Jordan. I'm excited for this Green Bay team moving forward with how young and talented it is. I think they're going to be making some noise very, very quickly in an NFC that doesn't have great quarterback play. So right now, if you're a Green Bay fan, you should be ecstatic. Because the future looks so bright right now with Jordan Love. It's amazing. The Packers, as an organization, for all the talk, all the times that we wanted to say, poor Aaron Rodgers, poor Aaron, they won't get him this, they won't do that for him. Green Bay, the Packers develop offense better than just about anybody in this league, it seems. Got multiple wide receivers for Love. Had wide receivers for Aaron last year. He just didn't want to work with them all that much. He was, you know, seemed like the grumpy old man sometimes with these young wide receivers, not very patient. Well, Packers develop offensive players better than just about anybody in this league. They develop old lines, too. Aaron never had a bad old line. Jordan Love's got a good old line in front of him. I think we need to apologize to Green Bay a little bit. Because right now, Green Bay's won. Green Bay's won the Aaron Rodgers, Green Bay, you know, beef fight there at the end. Packers are winning. Aaron's with a bad franchise, with a terrible offensive line. Tore his Achilles like 4 games in. Going to be 40 years old. Is he going to be good next year? Is Aaron even going to matter in this league again? I don't know. Packers will matter again real quickly, though. They already do. Sunday Night Football. Beat the reigning dynasty with their cheap quarterback, Jordan Love. So, all right. With that, let's talk some baseball. The winter meetings. I mean, the big news has already hit. Juan Soto dealt to the Yankees. I think that tells you, you know, we talked about on the show, are the Yankees just continue to be complacent when they didn't fire Brian Cashman? It felt like it. Well, clearly, it seems, even though they didn't fire Brian, they probably lit a fire under him. And the Yankees go out and make the deal for Juan Soto, giving up Michael King, Johnny Brito, who the shine has really come off Brito, Drew Thrope, who is the number 99 prospect in MLB's list of the 100 prospects, and then Randy Vasquez, which is New York's 13th ranked prospect, and they get Juan Soto and Trent Grisham from the Padres. San Diego needed to shed salary. Clearly, they took out a loan, so they desperately needed to get rid of this. This was the one that we all knew was coming down the pipe. And when it's all said and told, I don't think the Yankees gave up that much. Like I said, the shine had really come off Brito. Thrope is a top 100 prospect, but he's literally at the very end of it. And then your 13th-ranked prospect. I think Cashman won this deal A+. And I'm not even the biggest Juan Soto fan. Sometimes I think he can get a little overrated. But they won this deal. And then they added Alex Verdugo. Before that, which helps them because their offense was too reliant on the home run ball. But with Verdugo, they get a more contact hitter to even out the lineup and just diversify the offensive attack before they added Soto. So right now, I think the Yankees are killing it. And that puts Craig Breslow and John Henry officially on notice. What are we going to do? John, are you actually serious in investing in this team to win? Because the Yankees are, and they're out here making big moves. Sox have got to do something. I'm with Jesse 100%. I don't want to hear about what you're interested in. You've been the interest kings for 2 to 3 years. And it seems like that's mostly just so John can have something to point to and say to the fans, oh, we tried. We tried to do it, but we couldn't. Do something. Do something this offseason. Something has to go down. Doesn't have to be Ohtani. I don't even want Ohtani. I'll get into that after this. Don't even want Ohtani. But Eduardo Rodriguez, there's another pitcher you can check off. Another big player. Checked off, gone. Can't go get him now. He's in Arizona. Locked up by the Diamondbacks on a 5-year, $80 million deal. So, Breslow, John Henry, show me something. Let's do something. You got a young core here. The Yankees are going for it again. You need to go for it. Traded away Verdugo. I was fine with that. It seemed clear Alex at this point was not going to hit another gear, and he was due for arbitration soon. So, and you have enough left-handed bats in that lineup at either anyway, and you need pitching help. So traded into the Yankees for 3 different pitchers. One, an actual prospect. The second one kind of too young, and the other one on the older side with MLB experience. But I'm okay with trading away Verdugo, but Henry, Breslow, let's go. You're on notice. Let's do something. To the Shohei Ohtani talk. I'm trying so much not to be a hater. I feel like some old seam head and someone who wants to, you know, I don't know, pop the bubble, ruin everything, be a stick in the mud. But the more I've thought about this, the more I just, I can't come around on it. I think at this point, if a team pays Shohei Ohtani $500+ million, I think you're an idiot. I just think you're dumb. Shohei has pitched only 140 innings or more once so far in his major league career. He's about to have his second Tommy John surgery. If it's not his second Tommy John, it's at least his second sort of arm and shoulder surgery since coming to the big leagues. and he's going to turn 30 in July this year. And he's not going to be able to pitch again. He's not going to pitch this season. He's not going to be able to pitch again until next season, where he'll be 31 years of age, where he would have missed a second full season of pitching in the major leagues. Like, 30-year-old, you're going to pay him $550+ million. That's more the range it's going to be in. That's what we've talked. That's what the numbers have said. I think it's going to be the Dodgers. I've said that forever. I think the Dodgers literally took an almost off year this year, shredded some contract, didn't do anything big because they were gearing up to sign Ohtani. And they will have enough around Ohtani, at least probably on their roster, where they'll be a great team and then maybe they can win one. But the idea that you can pay one player $550+ million and you're going to win a championship, like, that's not how baseball works. Like, the Nationals won a title when Bryce Harper left. Like, you need more than just one guy. And the Dodgers at least will have the kids and the other things around it, so they'll have more than one guy. A team like the Giants, like, I know you have money, but still, at $550+ million, you cannot tell me that you're going to have the money to bring in a lot more around Shohei. And again, the great thing with Shohei was you get a pitcher and a hitter. Well, he's not going to be a pitcher next season. So you're going to be another year gone before you get that, and he'll be 31 years of age. If we could do this in the 350 to 450 range, I think maybe it's worth it. But I can't give a someone who's going to be 30 years old, not pitch again until they're 31. If we're talking the over 550 to the $600 million range, I just can't get behind it. I think the risk that you're taking that you could ruin your team for years to come, and the idea that maybe you're only going to get 3 great years out of the guy, like, I think it's dumb. I wouldn't do it. I know what it does, I'm sure, for ticket sales and interest, and, you know, I'm not looking at the projections. Maybe it makes you so much money that I'm dumb here and I don't know what I'm talking about and it's worth it, but purely from a baseball standpoint, I just can't get behind it. So that's my opinion on Shohei. I think he's going to the Dodgers, though, for sure. I've said that from the beginning. I know the Jays and the Giants are involved. I think the Dodgers, I just don't think the Dodgers allow themselves to be open. I think whatever it takes, they will get Shohei in Dodger blue. So, all right. With that, we'll take our final break here before we finish up with our gambling segment. So stick with us, guys. And we are back here at Slow Your Roll, getting ready to finish things off. Some final quick thoughts once more, actually, on the Sox before we move on to the gambling. You know, Eduardo, obviously off the market. Plenty of pitching still out there. Potential ones for trade. I know the price on Dylan Cease remains astronomically high. The asking price that the White Sox are asking for someone who had as bad and as down of the year last year as Dylan does. Now, I understand why the stuff plays up. He was like a Cy Young candidate the year before. And he's under team control still for 2 more years. So the cost control thing is a big reason. But the price remains astronomically high for a guy who had an ERA in the high fours last year. So that's part of that. I mean, if Breslow brought in Blake Snell, it's not like I wouldn't be sad. I wouldn't be upset. But I feel like they need multiple starters. So I kind of feel like they shouldn't go as high priced as Snell. And they should bring in like a Jordan Montgomery and then somebody else. But they'll remain in on those guys. A right-handed power bat is also a thing of need because they're so left-handed. Lourdes Gurriel remains out there. However, you know, we do have a lot of DH-type guys here in Boston already. Although Turner, likely they don't re-sign. I don't think they'll re-sign Justin. So that's what's out there right now. I'll believe Blake Snell when I see it. Like, John Henry hasn't shown that he wants to spend that kind of money yet. So, as Jesse said, they've been the interest kings for years. I think John's a little more invested this time around than the other 2 years because of what has happened at the end of seasons, how less the attendance has been and all that kind of stuff. I'm sure he wants to make more money again. But I don't know if he's all in enough that he's going to spend the kind of money it's going to take in to bring in Blake. But if bringing in Jordan Montgomery and maybe one other guy, I'll be happy. So, and I think Jordan Montgomery is going to come here. I do think that is one. I think he ends up in Boston. But with that, we'll finish things up with our gambling segment. And last week, one of my favorite weeks as a gambler ever. The only unfortunate thing is on this show, I said, guys, don't jump in the foxhole with me when I took Miami at -9.5 going against the professionals. But they covered easily, blowing out Washington, moving to 6-1 this season against the spread. Also, I told you the Cardinals had a very good chance to win outright in Pittsburgh at a plus, it was over 200. I believe it was plus 230 at the time that we did the show. It even moved to more, I think plus like 235, 240 by kickoff on the money line. Cardinals won outright. I had told you on this show that I had bet the spread already in that game. So we did okay. I did okay. The segment did good. A lot of things we said probably could happen did happen. So, yeah. So disclaimer before we get into this. If I do not specifically say that I have money on a game, though, we are not telling you to bet the game itself. This is explanation to help you. And just interesting tidbit. So right now as it stands, the biggest pros Joe's game of the week. Now, there's a couple of them you could choose from. This is the big one that I will choose. The Rams at the Ravens. The line opened at 7.5. It's moved down to 7, despite the fact that 71% of the bets are on the Ravens. That tells you all the money is on the Rams, which is why the line moved down. I mean, you know, Baltimore has blown out a lot of these NFC teams. We've talked about this. This is an element that if you don't play Lamar every year, like these NFC teams don't, it's hard to simulate him practice. You don't have a great look, and therefore you're unprepared when you get into this game. They blew out Seattle. They blew out the Lions. I believe it was Seattle. I think they blew out Seattle, and they blew out the Lions already this year. And Detroit's a decent team, and yet the Ravens blew the doors off them. So you'd think maybe this is a spot where Baltimore could do it again. However, I think what the pros are saying is as people have gotten some film on Todd Monken in this offense, it hasn't been quite as great. Also, missing Mark Andrews, the tight end, is a big part of this. And I think that they realize that the market was wrong on the Rams. And the Rams are a better team, at least when they're healthy. And I can never remember his name. But the DC that they hired, Raheem, I believe is his first name at least, has done a great job with the Rams. When they have Stafford and they have Kyron Williams and Puka and Kupp, and, you know, Nacua did sustain what they're calling, I believe, an AC joint in his shoulder sprain, but he's expected to play in this game. The big thing is when they have Kyron Williams and Sean McVay is able to use the run game the way he wants to be able to use it and the way that sets up everything else, that totally changes the dynamic of this offense. So I think they're thinking with Kyron Williams back and healthy, with Stafford healthy, with Puka, with Kupp, that even though it's in Baltimore, Baltimore without Andrews, Baltimore with a little more film on them, that the Rams can keep this game close. And at 7.5, giving the whole hook like that, that even though the Ravens are a better roster overall, the Rams really are still, you know, it's a ragtag group of older guys, a lot of young guys. They're very reliant on 5 or 6 guys. But they believe that this should be especially as the Rams fighting for a playoff spot now, 6-6. They believe that the Rams can keep this game a lot closer, and 7.5 is just too many points. If I was going to bet here, I'd probably bet the Rams. I have not put any money on this game. But as I said, right now, this is the Pros Joes game. 71% of the bets on the Ravens, and yet the line has moved down because all the money, which is the professionals, is on the Rams. So next one, explanation game. Sort of a weird line. Minnesota at the Raiders. Now, we saw how horrible Josh Dobbs was against the Bears on a primetime game. And yet Minnesota visiting the Raiders, despite the fact these two teams have very similar records, is a whole 3-point favorite. Now, I think what the market is betting on here is the Raiders had their dead cat bounce with Pierce for a little bit. They got off to a nice lead to start against KC, and then you just saw the whole building collapse against a KC offense that truly, other than that game against the Raiders, hasn't been that great this year. And yet they just shredded the Raiders for three quarters and ended up covering a huge spread despite being down 14-0 early. Minnesota also coming off a bye. I think they like Kevin O'Connell, the matchup of Kevin O'Connell and Brian Flores. Kevin O'Connell, obviously the head coach and offensive play caller for the Vikings, and then you got Brian Flores, the smart DC, giving them extra time to reset the ship. They get Justin Jefferson back, it seems like, in this game. And Brian Flores, his defensive scheme and a heavy blitz against the young rookie Aiden O'Connell, I think they believe is going to give O'Connell problems, and that's why this number is where it is. I have a hard time coming around on this one. I'm not going to bet it unless it goes up to 3.5. If I get the hook, I'll probably end up playing the Raiders. But right now, it's a stay away for me. And the pros are pretty split on this game. This is not a massive difference in professional and public money. But I thought it was a weird spread to have that number at 3, and that's at least what I've read and what I've heard from making calls on why. So now with the last one, a lot of times we do a game that either me and Jesse are on opposite sides of, or we do, as we did last week with the Arizona-Pittsburgh game, a team that we think can pull an upset straight out on a money line bet. You know, you got to be more than like 200 for us to do it. But this week, we're going to do something else. We're going to do what went wrong, because the public kind of got slaughtered this week. And there's three big games they got slaughtered on, and we'll explain the mistakes that the public made to get themselves the L's last week. First one, Seattle at Dallas. The line was 9.5 by kickoff. A lot of people bet the Cowboys after Seattle had been blown out by the Niners, trending down the way that the Dallas defense overwhelms average quarterbacks, but they were not considering the spot. First off, Thursday games are weird even of their own because there's less time to prepare, but also they caught Dallas at a time where maybe they were looking ahead to the Eagles a little bit, and Seattle was fighting for their playoff lives after being embarrassed by the Niners. So I think while I didn't think the number was egregious, and by the way, I bet Dallas, so I got caught with the public too on this one. Myself and the public, we did not consider enough the spot in which Seattle was in and the spot Dallas was in. Dallas looking ahead maybe to the Eagles game, and Seattle, after getting embarrassed, needing a win desperately to keep their playoff hopes alive. That's why they didn't cover. Dallas ends up winning the game. But I feel like you knew pretty early on you were on the wrong side if you bet Dallas at 9.5 in this game. All right, second one, another one that the public really got hammered on was Arizona at Pittsburgh. Love it. We gave this out on the show, bet the Cardinals money line. I had told you I'd already bet the spread. But a lot of the public was on the Steelers. And I think this was we talk about this all the time in gambling, right? Especially this is true when you watch a team get blown out on a primetime game. Now, Arizona wasn't blown out on a primetime game, but it was the blowout of the week when they had lost to the Rams. I mean, just completely dominated by the Rams. On the flip side, Pittsburgh had fired Canada. They had put up 400 yards of offense. They had beat a division team. But I think the public took too much stock into the candidate of getting fired, the 400 yards of offense, and too much stock into the Rams blowout of the Cardinals. We talked about it on the show. It's a matchup thing. Sometimes these in-division games are weird. It's a matchup thing where the Rams, Sean McVay, and their run scheme just matches up really good with the Cardinals and their defense. And it's not like the Steelers don't run the ball well. The Steelers run the ball extremely well, and they got Najee and Jaylen Warren, two different running backs. But their run scheme is just not the same as the Rams' run scheme. And for whatever reason, it's the scheme of the Rams that just consistently has given the Cardinals problems the last couple of years. It was no different 2 weeks ago. But I think the public overreacted, not realizing, thinking things through where it was just a matchup thing in division. Pittsburgh's still not a great offense. They're still not that explosive. It's not like the Rams thing where you have Stafford throwing the ball and you have to worry about Puka Nacua or Kupp on the outside. Like, it's Kenny Pickett throwing the football. And for anyone who wants to cry and say, well, he got hurt, you were down two scores when Kenny Pickett got hurt. If you bet Pittsburgh at 5.5 or 6.5, which is what it closed at, you weren't covering this spread no matter what. Maybe the Steelers would have won the game. I still doubt it. But you certainly weren't covering the spread. You lost this game even before Pickett went out. But overreaction to a blowout that had happened the week before was a big reason, I think, why the public got hammered on this one. And the final one, Kansas City at Green Bay. Number was 6. A lot of people bet the Chiefs. A lot of people teased the Chiefs down. There was a lot of people, public, on the Chiefs. The professionals were all over Green Bay in this game, and for good reason. The public didn't think of things as looking at what Jordan Love had done the last 2 weeks. Now, I go, they were against bad defenses, but he was clearly getting better. The game was going to be at Green Bay. But the biggest thing I think the public just did not take into consideration is at this point moving forward with the Chiefs, if you bet the Chiefs as a favorite of a touchdown or more, especially on the road, you're just a sucker. Like, this is not the same Kansas City offense. They struggle to put drives together. They struggle to put points together. They don't have great wide receivers. They consistently can't bring in passes on the deep ball, so there's not an explosive element to this offense. Kelce looks like he's lost a step. The best offensive player on the Chiefs, besides Mahomes, is their running back, Isaiah Pacheco. They're a better run team now than they are a passing team, which doesn't lend itself to usually covering big spreads. So I think at this point, you just have to realize with the Chiefs, if they're favored by a touchdown or more, even at home, you gotta think about staying away or betting the other team. And especially on the road. They just don't have the offense anymore to be winning a touchdown spread game on the road. Unless they're facing a truly horrid team. Like, they're going to play the Commanders. But right now, like I said, if you're betting the Chiefs as a favorite of a touchdown or more, you're kind of a sucker at this point. This is not the same offense. So, yep. So those are the three games that the public got slaughtered on this week. And just thinking things forward for the way you gamble this week and moving forward, just the traps that you fall into if you're one of these public bettors and why you lose money. Seattle, Arizona, KC, people with Kansas City thinking too much in the terms of the old Chiefs, Arizona Pitt reacting too much to the Cardinals getting blown out the week before, and with Seattle Dallas forgetting the spot or never really researching the spot the game was in, with Dallas having the Eagles after that and the Seahawks having just been embarrassed on television by the Niners, needing to bounce back and needing a win to stay in the playoff race. So that has been it for our gambling segment, and that has been it for Slow Your Roll this week. Have a great rest of your week, ladies and gentlemen. For anyone out there gambling this week, good luck to you. And we'll be back next week, probably with our regular thing, me and Jesse right here on the panel. Have a great rest of your week, guys.